Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is episode 12 of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen. The epic story of the star that gives us life. But this is chapter 9. I think that makes sense. And it's called The Earth's Move. I haven't read ahead on this, so this is a bit of a shock to me. And now I've just recently sunk into me some of the sort of science English things we have to say. So, universe, spelt with a small u, means... that means the observable universe. U, with a big U, refers to the more conceptual universe beyond the observable universe. So, sort of an important thing. Elements are common names, like helium and stuff like that. Units of measure are common names, like Newton, with a small n is Newton. But also what we've discovered here is this new phenomenon called, I didn't know, the Black Stone. Capital T, capital B, capital S, TBS. Unfortunately that actually does is a three-letter acronym there. But the Black Stone is the central meteor in the center of the cube, in the center of Mecca, which everything is really aimed at. It's pretty amazing to come across that. And the other thing is the Terminator, which is the actual night-day boundary, which is interesting. So here we've got some quotes. The first quote is this is the chapter called The Earth Moves. And see how many pages this is. It's a humdinger of a page. Let me see. 20 pages at least. First one is by Nicholas Copernicus. So he was, we'll find out a bit more about him, but I think he was a Polish religious person and very much concerned about a new model, but he had circles, not ellipses, and he says this, in the center of everything is the sun, nor could anyone have placed this luminary at any other better point, not without the grounds do we call it the world's lamp. By Martin Luther at the same time. People give ear to upstart astrologers who strives to show the earth revolves, not the heavens or firmament, the sun and the moon. He's a fool who wants to turn the art of astronomy on its head. Oh, so Martin Luther was not, he was at Reformation, but he didn't believe it. That's really amazing. While still as a teenager, Groucho Marx took it upon himself to be his brother's teacher. And one day he asked Harpo, 2 years his senior, how the world was shaped. Harpo confessed he wasn't sure. Groucho gave him a hint. What's the shape of cuff buttons? Square. I mean cuff buttons I wear on Sunday, not every day. Now what shape is the world? Round. On Sunday, square on weekdays, replied Harpo, who shortly after took his vow of professional silence. Dear. Oh, yes, he's the person who was always vicious. The town has been around for a long time, and the question, or even longer, what is the shape of the world? In the first century AD, Pliny the Elder concluded that it was a globe, but he also had a hedging theory that it was shaped like a pine cone. The encyclopedist Isidore de Seville would also... I think it's shaped like a pine cone. Oh dear. Which is not too bad. It's more oblate, more like a potter's wheel. Declared the world as circular, but flat like a wheel. The venerable Bede thought it a sphere, but could not imagine that people could live in the inverted antipodal feet opposite regions. The sages were mostly on their own, as from the 5th through to the end of the 10th century, Europe returned to the belief of a rectangular world, mapping orthodoxy puts Jerusalem in the centre. But when, in 999, the astronomer Gerbert became Pope Sylvester II... Oh, wow! So we've got Sultan's been astronomers, and we've got Pope's been... Sylvester II is an astronomer. He adopted Pliny's Globe as the church's doctrine. In 14th, isn't that amazing? The Pope, the astronomer Pope, there's a librarian Pope, a librarian anti-Pope. He looks ugly as well. In 1410, the appearance of Ptolemy's geography in Latin confirmed the by then generally accepted notion that the world was round. And by the century's end, as Columbus set out for the Indies. Ah, far out, something bit me. Something a little ant. How did that get there? Okay, so. Confirmed by then generally accepted notion that the world was round. By the century's end, as Columbus set out to the Indies, sailing from Spain, sailors and Santos alike embraced the idea of a spherical Earth, even if they were unsure of its size. It took a far later generation to show that it was rotations caused bulges at the equator, so it's not a perfect sphere after all. Okay, and this is, I think Newton found out that a pendulum set in Paris didn't work in the equator. In 1956, Thomas Blaney, influential the American pageant, stated without a line of evidence that Columbus's superstitious sailor grew increasingly mutinous because they were fearful of sailing over the edge of the world. Both Tolkien, with Arda, and C.S. Lewis, with Narnia, envisaged a flat world at least once in their fiction. While in 1910, a schoolmaster in Mississippi was dismissed for teaching the Earth was round. Otherwise, one is left with the Monty Python sketch, Crimson Permanent Assurance, in which the pirated office buildings plunges off the edge of the world. Okay, well. But where is our planet in relation to the rest of the universe? Among the masses, right, William Manchester, it could be continued, to be an article of faith that the world was an immovable disk around which the sun revolved. And the rest of the cosmos comprised of heaven, which lay dreamily above the skies, inhabited by cherubs and hells flaming deep beneath the European soil. Everyone believed, indeed knew that. Well, not quite everyone. An increasingly number of astronomers were finding that they could not make geocentric universe fit all the facts. Muslims and Christians might endlessly revise the Almagest, but none of the variants they came up with would compute the planetary positions in a way that would square with the increasingly accurate observations of the 16th century. It was not that no one had figured it out 400 years before Aristarchus of Samos advanced his notion of a heliocentric cosmos. Philosophers in northern India argued that the sun was the largest object in the universe, and if gravity were holding it together, they believed both to be true, then the sun had to be the centre. That's amazing. There were others. Early in the 11th century, Al-Biruni had come roughly to the same conclusion. The German theologian, later Cardinal Nicholas de Cusa, he is the person, he's a learned ignorant, had speculated the possibility. But before the advent of the printing press, and with no one to record their thoughts, such musings mostly died in the dark. That is an interesting thing that the printing press has an effect on it. Which is the story of Martin Luther King. The printing press has an effect. When, in 1510, Jonas Gutenberg finally invented the movable type, not only could these theories be preserved in print, but they could be widely disseminated. This is the interesting thing, that the Chinese had the printing press, but he, Gutenberg, moved moving type, a small thing. Readers could enjoy more information in less space, along with pagination, indexes, standardized punctuation, tabulated data, and accurately reproduced illustrations. While scholars, and this is a really important point, isn't it? Is that not an important point? So the printing press has been around for 100 years before Galileo. You know, it's a pretty amazing thing. I love the way he does that. Could discuss by letter with colleagues, no matter how far distance. By 1500, which is 50 years, printers' workshops could be found in every important Western European city. There were some 6 to 9 million copies in print of more than 35,000 published titles. In 1465, a 30-year-old astronomer from Kronzberg in Bavaria, Johann Müller, began to write and commission works on astronomy along with almanacs and tables. These books and papers given the need for tools to aid navigation exploration of an ever-present enthusiasm for astrology proved highly popular. Within 5 years, he had established himself in Nuremberg with his own observatory and printing shop. By the century's end, nearly every astronomical manuscript of value had been disseminated throughout the West. Enter Nicholas de Copernicus, 1473 to 1743, a shy, retiring cleric in the Polish-ruled East Parish, Prussia, who had become curious about the doctrines of heavenly spheres through the 10 years study in Bologna and Padua, only to find himself, like so many before him, having to make adjustments to accommodate the contortions of Ptolemy. How can Mercury and Venus never seem to stray far from the Sun, while Mars and Jupiter, Saturn sometimes move backwards? He was compelled to the idea of a heliocentric system, which fitted the evidence far better than Ptolemy's solution. Though still imperfectly, since, like everyone else, he continued to assume the planets travel in circular, not elliptical orbits. This is the thing I always say. He included Earth as another orbiting planet, a notion that he tried to dismiss as absurd, but it wouldn't go away. Now, 30, he returned to his home as a bishop, or as a bishop uncle, that Falcon of the Earth, as he sourly dubbed it, where he built a primitive observatory in one of the turrets in the wall surrounding the cathedral precincts. Following directions of the almagers, he set about constructing the same crude wooden instruments that had been used for centuries. See, guys, it's amazing. The almagers, Ptolemy, he's got a how-to thing. Around 1514, he began circulating copies of what later scholars would title De Hypostasis Motum Celestrum Asse Continuus Camerus, or The Little Commentary, which laid out his vision of the sun-centered system and asked his friends and fellow scholars for their opinions. At this particular moment, the Catholic Church was imbued with a growing enthusiasm for learning. I was happy to encourage original scientific research, as long as it did not openly challenge the doctrine. Pope Leo X sent an encouraging note, and liberal members of the Curia let it be known that they too approved. That's amazing. Plans were made to print a more substantial version. One would have thought that the basic thesis was self-evidently controversial, yet at this stage there is no hint of official challenge of the storm to come. In 1532, Copernicus' new system was given its first presentation by no less than Pope's private secretary to an invited audience of Vatican Gardens. The guests were favourably impressed. Copernicus began to win a degree of fame without actually having committed anything to public print. Yet still he hesitated, partly, no doubt, because he was unable to find any direct evidence that the Earth did move, let alone around the Sun, partly because he must have suspected that the Protestants, with their literal interpretation of the Bible, would be far less sympathetic to his friends in the Vatican. It's amazing. Almost 30 years would elapse before he allowed any extract from his work to progress to be included in the book on trigonometry. The whole came to 212 folio pages that appeared in 1543, in addition of a few hundred copies under De Revolution Urbans Cholestrum, or the Revolutionary of Cholestrum, which means, isn't that amazing? That's your first milk is Cholestrum, and it's heavenly spheres. By this time, the aging canon was 70, afflicted with apoplexy and paralysed from ear to heel. He saw the first copy come off the press only hours before he died. The scorn which I had feared, Copernicus writes in De Revolutionis, on account of the novelty and absurdity of my opinions, almost drove me to abandon the work already undertaken. That said, he was not bashful in claiming credit. It is true that a dedicatory letter to Pope Paul III, the pontiff who, de syllable reminds us, excommunicated Henry VIII and extended the remit of the Inquisition, he acknowledges that first he learned about the possibility of a moving earth from reading Cicero and discovered that Patriarchs and others had shared this view. But while he initially acknowledged the contribution from Aristarchus of Samos, in the last editing he struck all mention of him. Oh, amazing. That is amazing, isn't it? He outdid Aristarchus, however, in offering detailed models of the planet's passages around the Sun. Mercury is approximately 80 days. Our current figure is 87. Venus is 9 months. The Earth and Moon system is a year. Mars, not quite 2 years. Jupiter, 12. Saturn, 30. All reasonable estimates. He also managed to determine within 5% the correct values of the planet's least and greatest distances from the Sun. Which is interesting because they're circles. He said they're not perfect circles. He proposed that the Earth orbited the Sun, rotating once every 24 hours, thus making the stars appear to resolve in the opposite direction. He placed 6 known planets in their correct sequence in the Sun, but that is as far as he got. The spheres of the stars remain fixed, and the directory of the planets circular and not elliptical. Copernicus did not get everything right, but he diverted more than enough to stir up a bit of argument. Martin Luther, 1483 to 1546, one of the several leading churchmen who viewed the new theory as not only shocking but gravely in error, asked plainly, "Who will venture to place the authority of Copernicus above the Holy Spirit? After all," he continued, "Joshua commands that the sun will stand still, not the earth." As long as Copernicus' ideas were represented as hypothetical, Rome herself remained silent. The intellectuals in her flocks followed suit. For 50 years after his death, almost most astronomers privately acknowledged the importance of what had been revealed, but publicly maintaining their belief in the stationary Earth. The acceptance of a new heliocentric theory was far from a general right up till the time of Newton. The astronomer Patrick Moore has written, he's a famous, he's like the British Carl Sagan. And, quote, "And in the countries far away from the sphere of the Mediterranean culture, the old ideas persisted even longer. In China, Japan, the Jesuits continued to teach the received cosmology." Alright. The notion of a huge unknown universe, of which the Earth was only one minute part, would put much of the Christian apparatus of belief at risk, and that was not a thing to be taken lightly. The reaction of the baptized world recalls the wife of a Victorian canon of Worcester Cathedral, who, informed that Darwin's theory implied the descent of man from ape-like creatures, cried out, "Descent from the apes, my dear, we hope this is not true, but if it is, let us pray that it may not become generally known." See you. Are you going? Copernicus, ever reluctant revolutionary, had aimed to revitalize the Ptolemaic tradition of mathematical astronomy, not to supplant it. Again and again, his calculations fall into place alongside Ptolemy. The very structure of the revolutionists mirrors that of the Almagests, and its tables were no more accurate than those of the old orthodoxies! Despite this judgment, Copernicus continues to exercise the fascination on writers. Currently, Dave Sobel is writing a play about him, and Dennis Danielson, a Vancouver professor, has recently published a biography of George Ritters, the German professor of mathematics, who did so much work to help the revolutionists for publication, but received no acknowledgement. Reticulus, a central narrator of John Banville's novel Dr. Copernicus, Banville's winner of the 2005 Booker Prize for Fiction, has also written novels about Kepler and Newton. It's amazing. It had not been for Tycho Brahe and Kepler, there's a footnote on Kepler, on Tycho Brahe. Tycho Brahe is generally believed to be just Tycho. Of other major scientists, only Leonardo da Vinci is similarly foreshortened da Vinci. He had other gifts. Artists are often known by their first name. Michelangelo, Raphael, Indigo Jones. In Tycho's case, its easy consorting with royalty may have led to this fashion. Michelangelo would be. Concludes Otto Neuenberger acidly, the Copernican system would have contributed to the perpetuation of the Ptolemaic system in a slightly more complicated form, but more pleasing to philosophical minds. Arthur Koster is even more damning. In almost 400 pages devoted to the period of Copernicus to Galileo, he buries the Polish canon's reputation in characters stiffly, a stuffy pedant without a flair, the sleepwalking intuition of original genius, who, having got hold of a good idea, explained it into a bad system, patiently plodding on, piling more epicycles and difference into the dreariest and most unreadable among books that made history. Yet Copernicus did strike an original blow in genuine revolution. He was the first to take the idea of the Earth that rotates an axis every 24 hours around the central sun and work it into a comprehensive theory. And so we'll just check how many pages. Let's go. That's 4561. We've got 65. We've got 20 pages to go. Is it more? Oh. No, okay. It's around 61 to go. See how we go. We'll have to take a break at some stage. In 1546, 3 years after Copernicus died, there was born an astronomer who would model a cosmos that retained much of Copernicus's heliocentric theory but did not require the Earth to move. Tycho Brahe, his first name meaning hitting the mark, came from a Danish noble family, and growing up a Protestant, he inherited the worldview famed by strict interpretation of the scriptures. He saw his first eclipse as a freckle-faced boy at 14 and was struck that it had been predicted to the day. How could imperfect man anticipate the majestic acts of the heavens? He took up astronomy to find out. At 16, he observed how the connection of Jupiter and Saturn predicted by the still operative Julian calendar on August the 25th, 1563, was 2 days off if one went by Copernicus' table, and over many months if Ptolemy's. A conjunction occurs when two objects have the same celestial longitude and seem to occupy the same space. The astronomical system, he decided, was in dire need of overhaul. That would be his mission. The death of Tycho's hitting the mark's foster father, his uncle Johann Brahe, in 1565, brought him into his inheritance, and he soon built an observatory at Havard Abbey near Copenhagen, ransacking Europe for the finest instruments among the celestial oscilloscope, 5 feet in diameter, with a cost of 5,000 dalers, the equivalent of 80 years of a schoolmaster's salary. So I've missed a thing about conjunction. I'll read the conjunction song, and then the salary. Jupiter and Saturn are not only the largest of the sun's planets, but also the furthest consistently visible by the naked eye. They align only every 20 years. One theory holds that shift conduction in 7 BC formed the Star of Bethlehem, which the wise men predicted the coming of the Messiah. The next meet of the sky in December 2020. Oh, I'll have to be there. Now for the schoolmaster's salary. In other respects, Tycho followed the pursuits more typical of a young man of his time. During Christmas 1566, while in Germany University at Rostock, he assembled a dance and, the Westford and got into an argument that led a duel of the swords in the dark. Oh, there you go. I always thought he was in the Paris when he did it. His opponent sliced off a sizable chunk of Tucker's nose. Thereafter, the astronomer wore a prosthesis made of silver and gold blended into a fresh one with an adhesive balm to keep it falling off. In 1901, his tomb was opened and his remains examined by medical experts who claimed the nasal openings were rimmed with green, a sign that their false nose had been made of copper. Historians have speculated that he wore the lighter copper nose for everyday use as a more precious one for special occasions. Well, there you go. I didn't realise it was a 1901 thing. Okay. A massive mural quadrant, a great quarter circle made of brass. It had a radius of more than 6 feet, enabled Tycho to see exactly when the stars crossed the meridian. He added a huge sextant, which accurately measured the latitude and longitude of celestial objects. The complex also included a paper mill, a glassworks, a tubal intercom system. There you go. This is not only just a wharf and tunnels. It's got tubal flush toilets, a private jail, an instrument factory, a chemical laboratory, in effect, facilities sufficient to create the entire self-contained universe. On the evening of the 11th of November, 1572, Tucker was walking back from his observatory from Saturday when he was brought up short by a brilliant white light at shining Venus. Amazed, as if it astonished and stupefied, I stood still gazing with my eyes fixed intently, he wrote. I was led into such perplexity by this unbelievable thing that I began to doubt the evidence of my own eyes. He called several servants who confirmed what he done. Now, I have seen supernovas which have actually turned out to be Venus. People have just turned me around and reoriented me. I've become disoriented in the bush. So, oh, there's a supernova. Okay. Over the next 18 months, the light slightly northeast of the three stars that make up the right-hand stroke of the familiar W of Cassiopeia. This is in the northern hemisphere. And Cassiopeia has the famous Shedder star, which is the breast star. Lying outside the zodiac, it could not be a planet, nor did it fit the descriptions of comets. Sometimes it blazed so intensely that it could be seen in daylight. But by December, it had dimmed to the brightness of Jupiter, and by the following March, it was but a vivid point, modulating from white to red and finally to a leaden grey. Tucker modelled it until it disappeared around the 15th of March, so around March 1574. There was a new object in the sky that would require dramatic revision of the Aristotelian cosmology, for according to Aristotle, change and decay were confined to the world below the moon. Everything above was immutable. But something in the heavens was all too evidently changing, for Tycho witnessed was a huge stellar explosion, a star, a death rays, a phenomenon that would one day be known as a supernova. Tycho, which is close to the mark, was the first astronomer to note to work with out the aid of a telescope, was an age with respect for new hard facts. He became the most gifted observer on record. His naked eye measurements accurate to the arc minute, 160th of a degree. He was just a bit of a savant. Human eye, superb long distance instrument, able to discern on a clear night a candle flame at 7 miles away. Tucker's rigorous catalogue and planet and stars listing 1,000 and later of the latter, and in 1573 published On the New Star, a pamphlet about the supernova that helped establish its reputation. The following year he gave a Latin inaugural oration. I love the idea that he had flushing toilets and speaking tubes. He gave a Latin inaugural oration at the Copenhagen University. The entire academic community attended attendance. In our time, he began, quote, Nicholas Copernicus, who has justly been called the second Ptolemy from his own observations, found out something that was missing in Ptolemy. He chose the hypothesis established by Ptolemy emitted something unsuitable and offending against mathematical axioms. He therefore arranged, with admirable skill of his genius, his own hypothesis in another manner, and thus restored the science of celestial motions in such a way that nobody before him had considered more accurately in the course of heavenly bodies. For, although he devises certain features opposed to physical principles, e.g. the sun rests at the center of the universe, that the earth and the elements associated with it and the moon above the sun in triple motion, and the eight spheres remains unmoved, he does not for all that admit anything absurd as far as mathematical axioms are concerned. Tycho knew the old system failed to make sense, but he was unwilling to let go of the earth at the centre of everything. He produced what became known as the Tychonic system, which resembled that of Copernicus, except it had two centres, the earth and sun. The planets other than earth orbited the sun, while the sun orbited the earth. A fine compromise between Bible and science, if to our ideas untenable. But Tycho was an observer, not a theorist, and was pressed on unperturbed. His account of the supernova both intrigued Frederick II and led him to worry that his leading astronomer might have to leave Denmark for more tempting pastures. Oh, this gives a lot more to it. So now I know the Tychonic systems. The king decided to grant Tycho the remote island of Haven, situated midway between Zealand and Sweden. Its cliffs 100 feet high and a clear sight of the great fortress of Frederick was rising at Elsinore. With it came a generous endowment consisting of rents from the island's householders for the rest of his life. At one point in 1580s, Tycho commanded 1% of the Danish entire income.
Well, I said it was given to me as 10%, but it's 1%. I'll take that one more realistically.
He immediately set to work on two new observatories at Haven: the underground Castle of the Stars, unshakable in any storm, and a larger complex above ground, the Castle of Uranus. This is, I wonder if they say that Shakespeare is named after the Greek god of the skies. The latter named his museum, literally Temple of the Muses, boasted ramparts, pavilions, botanic gardens, fountains, aviary, a print shop, cellars, towers. But by the time it was all completed, there was no other place quite like it anywhere in the world. In November 1577, Tycho was fishing one of the island's many ponds, his workers hauling in the nets. He noticed what looked like another new star. At dusk, faded into night, he saw that it had a reddish tail stretching away from the sun, unmistakably a signature of a comet. A word originally meant head of hair in Greek. Aristotle appropriated it because he thought comets, as we now know, no more than conglomerates of ice and dirt, looked like hairy stars. Tycho rushed to one of his observatories, where he determined the new comet's position by measuring the angle and distance to the two nearest stellar neighbours. For 4 months he tracked the fading dash across the skies and found it had no measurable parallax, a phenomenon exemplified by something moving objects in the foreground against those in the background of the head.
So the comet is in dark space, right? So it's in dark space. So if it's in dark space, deep space, it can't be between the Earth and the Moon.
He reported to the king. He calculated the objects at a distance of more than 230 times the radius of Earth, four times that between the Earth and the Moon. Because I think the Earth is, well, we're 1,240, so how many times? Four, yeah, that's okay. Even though Tucker's calculations are badly off, this, and even more than an earlier supernova, convinced him that Aristotle was wrong. Separate spheres could not be spinning above and below the moon.
He postulated instead a common atmosphere pervading the universe in which novas and comets could burst out anywhere. The old doctrine of multiple spheres, he wrote, a theory that authors have invented to save appearances, exists only in imagination so that the motions of the planets and their due courses may be understood in the mind. So he got rid of that. From his mid-30s on, Tycho became progressively more eccentric. He kept a dwarf named Jep, who he believed had powers of clairvoyancy, and who sat underneath his dinner table unless required as a jester, feasting on tidbits fed him by his master, and a tame elk, and that would wander upstairs to an empty room and lapped up so much beer that it crashed down the stairs and broke a leg and died. But it's not he, it was a, it was the elk. Was, friend. Now, there's actually so many mad Danish people. I think there must have been some sort of poisoning going on. In 1588, Frederick II died. He, too, from a surfeit of drink, and his son, being only 10 years old, for the next 9 years, there ruled a series of regents. All were Tycho's friends, so nothing changed. But the new king, Christian the fourth, turned 19. He determined to shut off all favours his rattle-brained stargazer had enjoyed for over a quarter of a century. Tycho quit the island, taking with him his students, servants, and instruments and printing press, and set up in Catholic Prague. Oh, this makes sense, because Kepler's in Prague. Isn't that amazing? Okay. Here he built the last observatory, Bacharachy Castle, about 30 miles outside the city, where, until his death in 1601, he spent the time writing poetry and summarising his research. But he published not a word more. Mm-hmm. It was during this period, actually, 1592, that two of Tucker's carriages by marriage, Frederick Rosick and Kudstein, which means a golden star, travelled to England, diplomatic mission. Oh, yes, this is a going thing. In the course of which Shakespeare apparently learned about them and introduced them to Hamlet, completed around 1601. Introduced who famously untrustworthy courtiers. It was probably not an unfair portrait, at least in the case of Rosick, who had years before impregnated a lady-in-waiting, for which outrage he had been sentenced to forfeit his title and lose two fingers. But he escaped that fate by enlisting against the Turks. But courtiers enjoyed further fame when Tom Stoppard re-immortalised them in Runnels and Gerson Are Dead. Well, there you go. Well, it's a book. So it is well known about Shakespeare writing about Hamlet and Tycho. I just can't quite put this all together. Okay. The year before Tycho left Haven, he was, what I don't understand is that I believe that Kepler was at his court in Haven, but okay. He was the first sent the publication by a 25-year-old German school teacher of astronomy and mathematics. Johannes Kepler was a short-sighted, surly, reckless, erratic, and poor, and from a poor, severely dysfunctional family. His mother. I wonder if we get the drinking death story here. His mother, so it's, had been accused of witchcraft. Her son fittingly had the devil's own job of saving her from the stake. He was also a genius. His Mysterium Cosmographium, Cosmographic Mysteries. I'll have to finish up here.
Starting again on Kepler. He was also a genius. His Mysterium Cosmographium, Cosmographic Mystery, did not take one far away from explaining the universe, in the way of explaining the universe, as it held the notion of concentric spheres, but it did show the author's powers of original thinking. And Kepler did place the sun at the centre. Tycho invited him to visit, but Haven proved to be too far from Kepler's home in Graz. 4 years later, however, with Tycho now close to Prague, such a journey became practical. And when, in 1598, Kepler, a Lutheran, saw the school, his school, closed by order of the Jesuit-educated Archduke Ferdinand, the die was cast. So he was out of a job. On the 4th of February, 600, Tycho's 53, Kepler 28, finally met face to face, silver nose to scabby cheek. Isn't that beautiful? Quote. They spent 3 fractious, not particularly satisfying months in each other's company. The Dane, suspicious and secretive, the young German, obstinate and critical. During which Tycho insisted that, before Kepler returned to Graz, to bring order to his family affairs, he should pledge in writing to reveal nothing about his host's works. But when that same year Tycho, his principal assistant, returned to Bremer, Kepler was invited to move in permanently. Although the two men seldom spoke to one another except at meals, when Tycho died the following October, Kepler found himself appointed to the post of imperial mathematician, a position that would have been Tycho's had it not been too lofty for an aristocrat for such a job. Kepler's immediate set to work drawing on Tycho's vast, precise observations to advance his own theories, several of which, as the motion of planets, were the opposite of his benefactors. So it's pretty amazing. Now, the story I was told is that this is completely fictitious. I was told that Kepler stole their work and took it to Prague, but of course Tycho moved to Prague, so this shows that some of the histories I've read are bogus. By 1605, Kepler's main researches were completed. That is to say, he had worked so hard on his calculations during these years that he could have died 10 times. Interference from Tycho's heir slowed down the publication of his finding, but at last, in 1609, Kepler's new astronomy appeared. It established 2 cardinal principles, that the planets move not in circles, but ellipses, and their speeds vary according to their distance to the speed of the Sun. So Kepler's laws are, they eat out the equal amount of area. So the way I like to do it is you've got an elliptical pizza, and you can cut from the focus, but you've got to make sure everyone gets the same size slice. In other words, it means that the time for a planet to move through a slice is the same each time. It established that the planets move in circles, and not circles but ellipses, and their speed varies according to the distance of the Sun. The Vatican called his views heretical, as it is considered only circular paths perfect. Kepler replied that celestial imperfection was there to enable God to make better music, since he had used a musical scheme to establish the position and motions of the planets around the Sun. Here we go. In this, he was returning to Pythagorean beliefs of celestial harmony, according to which heaven's spheres made music as they spun. Kepler realized that previously he had seen the most harmonious scheme of the heavens, uniform circular motion, could generate only a monotone for its sphere. Heavenly bodies moving at variable speeds could generate more notes, which combined with other bodies would create complex polyphonic harmonies of a much richer system. Well, there you go. That's the most incredible story. That they believe that as they were moving, they were generating music. She is. He was also able to strengthen the claims for Copernicus and Tycho. The stars were immensely further away than anyone had supposed. The universe of Kepler was vast beyond imagining. Now look, this is really incredible. So the point that I find is the Pythagorean harmony of the spheres is put in by Kepler. The great philosopher Blaise Pascal, 1623-62, would abandon science and devote himself to religion. It was to respond to these revelations by having this aesthetic libertine of his penis cry out, "The eternal silence of these everlasting spaces terrifies me." It terrified Kepler too, who heard to explain, "The infinite is unthinkable," but his findings strengthened rather than undermined his religious belief. "Whoever is too stupid to understand astronomical science," he declared, "or too weak to believe in Copernicus without affecting his faith, I will advise him that, having dismissed astronomical studies and having damned whatever philosophical opinions he pleases. He mind his own business and betake himself home to scratch his own dirt patch. Wouldn't that be a fantastic thing? Wouldn't it be fantastic if people who are ignorant got out of the way and just let you research? But no, they just pulled you down. Between them, Copernicus, Tycho and Kepler lay the foundations of the scientific revolution of the 17th century. Although virtually no astronomer practicing at the time of Tycho's death had believed in the heliocentric cosmology, all employed Copernican techniques. And as Owen Gingrich, Harvard's professor of astronomy, says, it was Kepler, the world's first astrophysicist, who, the man who really forged the Copernican system as we know it. By the time Kepler's death, 30 years later, the entire profession was doctrinally Copernican and accepted not only Tycho's evidence of how the stars move, but Kepler's theories on how the planets did too. Cosmology had been transformed by three men's discoveries and by the appearance of the telescope. But that's a different story. The story of Galileo. Here's a quote. I found what it's from. From Brecht's play. In the year 1609, science light began to shine. In Padua City, in a modest house, Galileo Galilei set out to prove the sun is still and the earth is on the move. So begins Bertolt's play Galileo, originally entitled The Earth Moves. It opens with Levitico, who is courting Galileo's daughter, calling on the scientist at his home at Padua, then part of the Venetian Republic. Quote, I saw a brand new instrument in Amsterdam, he tells his host, who is at the point professor in mathematics. A tube affair had two lenses at each end. One lens bulged and the other was like that, he guesses. Any normal person would think that different lenses cancel each other out. They didn't. I just stood and looked a fool. Galileo asks if it is a recent invention. It must be, Ludovico. And they only started peddling it on the streets a few days before when I left Holland. The Lionsbrook gives the young suitor reflects that the actuality happened in Holland, and Galileo's reaction in the play is also true to history. Ever the entrepreneur, he learned to grind and polish lenses as soon as he put together his own superior instrument. Venice was necessarily an unwalled city, which made early detection of enemy attack vital. On the 8th of August 1609, he came before the Duchess Assembly Court, which he invited the Tower of St. Mark's Cathedral to demonstrate his appliance, application of his device. As Brigham Creed writes, the elderly senators had to be restrained from fighting over the chance to the next climb to the roof to scan the horizon for ships. They were like children with a new toy. Having shrewdly presented the showpiece, Galileo, academic stamping nearly doubled from 520 to 1,000, the equivalent of $300,000 a year. His professorial tenure was confirmed for life. The portraits we have of early Galileo show him as a beefy, ginger-haired, short-necked, coarse-featured. They plainly suggest his stubborn nature and abrasive assertiveness. Quote, a diverted career with a genius for public relations. He now claimed to be the original begetter of the instrument, which he preferred to be called a tubus, which was his skill as a lens maker, and not until 1830 that anyone produced a high magnification. But, in fact, there were several begetters before him. So, when did you do this? Well, my God. Roger Bacon, our famous one, is probably the earliest person to have developed a far-seeing instrument in the West. And that's true because he invented the magnifying glass. Chinese astronomers had come up with something similar even before that. Leonardo has left intriguing hints in his diary and notebooks that he may have discovered the telescope before the 15th century was out. Make mirrors to make the moon big, quote, and in order to observe the nature of planets, open the roof and bring the image of a single planet onto the base of the concave mirror. The image of the planet reflected in the base will show the surface of the planet much magnified. Where's that from? I don't know. This is I don't know where this quote's from. Over the years, however, Dutch linengrinder Hans Lipschi had been generally acclaimed as the main inventor. Magnifying glasses became common in the 13th century, but these were cumbersome, especially for writing. Craftsmen and inventors began making small disc glasses, convex on both sides, to be worn in a frame, spectacles. Because they shaped like lentils, they became known as lentils of glass, and hence the Latin's lenses. Well, that's true, lenses, but I think the actual, they were play actual glass lentil play things before we get in. So it's a slightly different things. So I was told a slightly different version of all that, the monks had these little beads of glass and they look like lentils. So lens and lentils is true. Hans Shibley has been generally claimed as the main inventor. In late 1608, he claimed to have discovered that the combination of convex and convex lens could make distant objects look nearer. In September of that year, he presented a pair of biscuit-sized lens fixed to a tube to the German prince, Maurice of Nassau. By the following April, spyglasses could be bought by the spectacle makers' shops all along the Pont Neuf de Paris. The Dutch prototype magnified a factor of 3. Very soon, there were instruments capable of magnifying more than 20-fold. It was Galileo who got credit for using telescopes to examine the heavens. I started to think of a more surprising discovery to the entire history of science. It was its Noel Sewell Lord in about 2 months, December to January 1609 to 1610. He made more discoveries that changed the world than anyone has ever made before or since. Hyperbole, but understandable. Within 7 months of his presentation to the Doge, Galileo was describing the findings in terse, decorative style, insidious, noxious, starry messenger. Although he himself seems to have intended it to mean the message from the stars. I have seen, he wrote, stars in profusion, stars that I have never seen before, who surpass the old previously known by more than a factor of 10. But what will excite the greatest astonishment by fire is namely that I have discovered 4 planets. The profusion of stars refers to the Milky Way, the telescope suggested, which the unaided could not, if the heavens had depth. The idea of the Milky Way was not a streak across a multitude of stars, but crowded together of uncountable brilliant spots of light was astounding. Oh shit, someone's got ants biting it inside of me, inside my t-shirt. But I'll read on. The planets that Galileo was seeing were Jupiter's 4 major satellites. The word satellite comes from the Latin satellites, attendant at court. Ah, well, there you go, court attendance. It was first used astronomically in a letter to Kepler wrote to Galileo in the summer of 1610. Almost immediately afterwards, for no discernible reason, Galileo broke off all contact and refused throughout his life to acknowledge Kepler's law of elliptical orbits. For him, everything in the heavens went round in circles. Well, there you go. That is the most amazing thing. And he also... Isn't that amazing? Isn't that... absolutely amazing. Oh, that is absolutely amazing. That circle stuff. That's eating me alive. It's eating them up. Okay. That is amazing. Galileo snubs Kepler because he offers ellipses. What a horrible man. The planets are known as the Galileans. Their discovery proved that planets other than Earth have objects that orbit around them, which strongly supported Copernican view that the solar system where Jupiter fixed to a crystal sphere, these means would have shattered it. Now, the telescope enabled Galileo to produce the first systematic drawings of the moon. Venus had phases and showed the planets to be very much larger than previously thought. There followed a greater discovery yet. The sun had blemishes, spotty and impure, what Galileo had seen with sunspots. Moreover, he had watched them move along with the solar surface, which meant the sun itself was revolving. Preoccupied with determining the periods of Jupiter's moon and protecting his position at court, he did not give as much attention to these markings as his earlier finds, confessing did not know and could not know the material the solar spots may be, but they appeared to him to be almost like clouds. Okay. The others before him may have seen objects across the solar disk. But it was Galileo's account that astounded a wider audience and made him famous. In 1911, he made a triumphant visit to the Vatican. Exclamation mark. A banquet there suggests he coins the word telescope, Greek pharsia. Now, what was it, the star I missed? Did you get wrong? There was a bell satellite that turned into quartz. I remember that one. Now he's granted a private audience with Pope Paul the. Has ever been fine art to enable the judge whether Rome would applaud or condemn him? And Gallo seems to have reined himself in, and perhaps mindful, quip made by a crucial cardinal in the Bible was intended to teach us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Oh, look. Three other astronomers now came forward to claim that they too had noted such marks. The English scientist Thomas Harriot, two Germans, Christopher Schneider and Jones Goldsmith. The Latinized T. Fabricus. Each issued pamphlets, being Fabricus, an account that took proudly to Frankfurt's book fair in the autumn of 9/11. Harriet, a steward in Sir Walter Raleigh's household, made 199 observations of sunspots between December 1610 and January 1613. He just never published them. Schneider, a Jesuit priest, had made his observations on the 21st of October, 14th December 1610, and did not publish his book until 1612. Galileo's first sunspot drawings belong to the 3rd and 11th of May 1612. It generally seems that each of the four men separately detected the phenomenon and was not passing it off another's finding as his own. Who deserved credit was Galileo's claim that touched off the ensuing debate. Schneider's observation that the sun had blemishes was discounted by fellow Jesuits, but he argued that spots were not strictly solar, rather than silhouettes of a previously undiscovered small planets revolving around the sun's surface. After all, he said, reverently echoing Aristotle, the sun was perfect and could not be blemished. The following year, Galileo replied in letters on sunspots to three public epistles in which he asserted the marks did indeed lie on the sun's surface. His evidence was that sunspots displayed a peculiar speed-up and slow-down motion as they crossed the sun, becoming elongated and foreshortened as they neared the edges, exactly as the behaviour of something fixed to the surface of a globe. There's a footnote here. Robert Burton, 1577 to 1640, characterises the confusions wrought by the Zwinglian views in his classic Anatomy of Melancholy, a wide-ranging inquiry into contemporary science and the Ills of Society, first published in 1612. And so, he writes, while fools are running away from one vice, they plunge into the opposite one. As the tinker stops one hole and makes two, he, the latest astronomer to pronounce his view, corrects them, and thus worse himself, reforms some, and mars all. In the meantime, the world is tossed into a blanket amongst them, and hoists the worlds up and down like a ball, make it stand and go at their pleasure. One day the sun stands, another he moves, a third he comes in, taking them all at rebound. At least there should be any paradox he be wanting. He finds certain spots and clouds in the sun, and by the help of glasses thus disagree amongst themselves. Bit of a blur quote, if you ask me. The last three letters, Galileo, possibly looking for a fight, made his first public endorsement of Copernicus' system. The letter enraged Rome, which had given clear notice of its intentions in 1590 in the case of the Neapolitan London philosopher Gordino Bruno, nicknamed the Exasperator. He was a true autistic person. I think he got burnt in 1599, so it's 10 years. Remedio declared that a rotating earth in orbit around the sun was an unassailable fact. The Inquisition convicted him of being the worst kind of heretic, parenthesis, demoted God from a supreme creatorship, and had him transported on a mule to Rome's Campo di Fori, where he was hanged upside down, stripped naked, and burnt at the stake, an iron spike driven through his tongue to prevent further blasphemies. Well, that's a bit of a different story from what I've read. That the what maybe happened may come through, but I think he just there were 10 reasons that he wouldn't recant on them. And I think it was the multiple planets one. line that upset them. And he thinks about the Virgin Mary that he said. He said the Virgin Mary was a normal person. So I had to really read into Bruno. But I think that this is example. What I don't quite understand is that I think he was burnt in St. Peter's Square just outside the Vatican. So these are different stories. I've just got to reread it and get this through. For years, Catholics had been forbidden to read Copernicus unless the crucial 9 sentences claiming his ideas were more than theory had been deleted. When these were removed, the congregation of the index would finally ban the work. I do like the congregation of the index. And it's really interesting, the inquisitions. I think people have to understand there's many different flavours of inquisitions, Spanish being the worst. And the papal inquisition was actually quite benign. False Pythagorean doctrine that the earth moves around the sun is, and the sun is motionless. Galileo could no longer escape. He summoned before the Holy Office on the 26th of February 1616. A report was filed saying that he had been commanded to give up Copernicanism and to abstain altogether from teaching or defending his opinion or even discussing it. Now, this is, I disagree with whoever's written this, because he wrote this play, Sabbatico, and really upset the Pope. It's another thing. He still was not condemned, but told to direct himself to other studies. There, matters rested for 7 years until Maffeo Barberini, once an astronomer himself, was elected Pope Urban IV. So they've got these papes are astronomers. These popes are different astronomers. I wish I could remember. So I remember one pope was an astronomer, but I can't remember when and why. A papal astronomer was a, had the earth been round. Long-time friend of Galileo, he now invited him to Rome. Over the course of 6 audiences, the two men strolled the Vatican Gardens discussing the heliocentric thesis. Urban is said to have told his conferee that he could not revoke the 1616 commendation, but urged him nonetheless to develop a formal comparison of Copernican and Ptolemaic systems. On one condition, no conclusion was to be drawn of the truth of either theory, since God alone understood the workings of the universe. What a genius, but I think he really hated him nonetheless. Galileo set to it, and it took him 9 years. Finally, with the approval of the local censor in Florence, he produced the dialogue of two chief world systems, writing the first edition in vernacular Tuscan, the second in scholarly Latin. Okay. One of Beck's characters says Galileo wrote the language of fishwives and merchants. Maybe he knew other tongues when to employ them. The common use of Latin, he writes, which continued to be the language of the learned to the beginning of the 18th century, made for easy exchange of ideas and what was discovered or suggested in one country to be quickly taken up by other countries. God, please to make me the first observer of an admirable thing kept hidden all these ages. The weight of his argument was clear. The heliocentric version was scientifically indisputable. The earth was in motion because mathematics demanded it to be. I really think this is absolutely not correct, because there was this play Simplicio, but this is a bit more information about it. It's but I like the way that Galileo shunned Kepler, and Tycho couldn't have Copernicus because he was a Protestant. This is all in there. In a formal trial the following year, Galileo was condemned on vehement suspicion of heresy. Heliocentrism per se was never declared heretical, either ex cathedra or enumerated council. It was just, as one commenter puts it, Galileo was intent on ramming Copernicus down the throat of Christendom. Kepler, for one, was furious with his fellow scientists. Some, through their impetuous behaviour, have brought matters to such a pass that reading Copernicus' works, which is absolutely free for 80 years, is now prohibited. In effect, Galileo forced the Church to silence him.
I think Bruno, there's all these people, victims, can direct the action. So Bruno definitely did. I'll have to really read about Bruno. Bruno is an absolute hero of me, and the more I read, the more I get different inclusions. So he had a great memory, a mathematical mind, and he just irritated everybody, Bruno, until he got himself burnt. Brett claimed the scientists were threatened with Iraq and other instruments of torture, but of this there is absolutely no evidence. Mark it down to the urban legend. If anything, Kuril officials took particular pains to avoid a collision. During his trial, Galileo, by the time 70, was housed in a five-room apartment overlooking the Vatican Gardens. He was even accorded a valet and another servant to look after his food. Happily for the church, on the 22nd of June, 1633, he fell to his knees in the great hall of the Dominican convent of Santa Maria Sopra Niobe and recanted. Perhaps because, in the end, he was a devout Catholic, he saw the larger point that the Holy See wanted to make. Science cannot be seen as the ultimate source of authority. Okay. Just really interesting. That was the main point, I suppose. Here's a quote, a footnote for authority. Aristotle had asked, if the Earth did indeed orbit the Sun, then why were not stellar parallaxes observable? That is, there ought to be a shift in position of fixed stars as seen from the Earth from side to Sun. Then 6 months later, the other side. Tycho had not resolved this question, and even with the best telescopes, Galileo was able to detect such changes as the stars were too far away. This issue was not resolved until 1838, when a German astronomer, Friedrich Bessel, published the first reliable measurement of the stars' apparent annual shift. I just really, yes. So you've got your stellar parallax. My memory is going. My memory really is going. Let's read a bit more here. He was forced to acknowledge as part of his detection he did not have incontrovertible evidence that he was right. Oh yeah, that reminds me. I did read the papal reports into him, and they focused in on his calculation of star size, which was, he didn't understand the resolution of his telescope, so he said they have to be far away, so they have to be massive. And he was actually using more religion than the Pope was. It was pretty amazing to reread through it. When his sentence was imposed, it was that he'd confined to his villa in Acre, just outside Florence, where he spent the rest of his life at his studies, in particular the science of dynamics. By 1837, he had lost his sight, though not from observation of the sun, one eye at a time. The following year, he received several visitors, including Hobbes and Middleton, the latter of whom, 6 years on in Aprogata, recalled discussing cosmology with Galileo. Grown old, a prisoner of the Inquisition, for thinking of astronomy otherwise than Franciscan and Dominican licenses thought, Milton returned to the subject of Paradise Lost. Solicit not thy thoughts with matters hid, leave them to God above. Him serve and fear. Heavens is not thee too high to know what passes there. Be lowy wise. I don't know what that means. In the same poem, he describes Satan's landing on the sun as creating a mark of spots, as seen through a gazed optic tube by a telescope. An endorsement? Anyway, his advice came far too late. At least Galileo, contrary to legend, did not spend a single day in prison cell. He wrote two comic plays, lectured on Dante, and continued his academic studies before dying in 1642 at the age of 78. In a generation which saw the 30 Years' War, wrote Alfred North Whitehead, the worst that happened to men of science was that Galileo suffered an honourable detention and mild reproof before dying peacefully in his bed. Almost 100 years later, Benedict the 14th would grant an imperator Rome's formal permission to publish to first edition of Galileo's complete works, even though paradoxically the ban on Copernicus's works lingered to 1828. Wow. Another 230 years would pass before John Paul II commissioned a study of Galileo's case in 1979. Now, that case was absolutely
absolutely fascinating, because they went down and they found missing apostrophes and badly written Latin, and the actual uncovered heaps of information that's well worth read. After more than 12 years further deliberation, in 1992, the Vatican finally conceded Galileo was justified in what he said then. In March 2008, Benedict the whatever he is, announced that the statue of the great man would be erected in the Vatican walls. The head of the Pontifical Academy of Science, himself a nuclear physicist, declared, "The Church wants to close the Galileo affair and reach a definite understanding not only of its great legacy, but the relationship between science and faith. Even by the standards of a great institution, it was just a little slow." There is reason why the arguments took so long to become accepted. Technologies profoundly affect belief systems, and only with the invention of a printing press could ideas spread widely. Still, where such notions involved a revolutionary new way of thinking, there's bound to be great resistance. Sigmund Freud, beaten to death here, 1858 to 1939, popularized the view that Copernicus had caused a particular consternation by moving mankind from his preeminent position at the center of the universe. In fact, the distress was even greater in the wake of Galileo's revelation about sunspots. I think it's sunspots and craters on the moon, as far as I read. There was something horrible about the sun not being perfect. I think sunspots, now I realize sunspots are perfect. If it ravages the human face had been translated into the mighty disc magnified, before Galileo the sun had been impeccable sphere. Suddenly it was grubby and mottled. With the event of the telescope, 17th century man had to frame things anew. Not from an imaginative interpretation. Sun gods, chariots in the sky, dragons devouring a solar disk, but by repeatedly qualifying and sieving at vast the latest evidence. He must have been profoundly deracinating to think of that this great star was, despite being the centre of the solar system, only a small part of the Creator's purpose, and a spotted one at that. Beautifully written. And I'll get this one out. We'll see how it goes. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.